Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Uber's estimated $90 billion IPO is coming later this week. It's the biggest public stock offering in years and will take the company into the next phase as a game-changing tech giant. But that doesn't mean Uber is leaving its past behind, those problems that come with its growth-at-all-cost culture, and the pesky fact that it hasn't yet turned a profit. Uber lost $1.8 billion last year, according to its own IPO filings, a fact that Uber CEO Dara Khosrowshahi acknowledged to CNBC.
I think we have to show a path to profitability.
Well, it's funny how things work in the gig economy. Uber has an earnings problem, but it's thrilling the market with its multi-billion dollar IPO. But also not making enough money? The very drivers Uber relies on.
I want better earnings. I want them to acknowledge we have a big problem.
That's driver Kevin Ragu speaking to NBC News. He's one of thousands of drivers striking in cities around the world today. They're protesting poor wages and working conditions. And Uber itself admits that it will have to further cut driver incentives to find that, quote, path to profitability in the future. So it is all within one company, the story of the wider economy today. This hour on Point, Uber's IPO and inequality in the gig economy. And you can join us. Are you excited about Uber's $90 billion IPO? Or will you forego calling for a rideshare today in support of striking drivers? If you're an Uber or a Lyft or any ride-hailing service driver, is this the cost? Is this the price of innovation in the gig economy? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, we will start today in San Francisco, California, a city that is headquartered to Uber. Joining us is Rebecca Stack Martinez. She's an Uber driver who's helping to organize protest efforts there through the activist group Gig Workers Rising. She will be protesting in front of Uber headquarters later today. Rebecca, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So first of all, tell us, what specifically is it about your experience as an Uber driver that's led you to be out in the streets in front of Uber headquarters today?
Well, that's a more complex answer, but to make it brief, Uber has been in existence, it was a very profitable gig to be in, and over time they have consistently cut the rates and what they pay their drivers. And so it's become increasingly hard, especially in San Francisco, to earn a decent living doing this gig.
Okay. And so what more then? Tell us what more are drivers asking for from Uber?
So we're asking for, one, for them to give us a living wage after expenses. As independent contractors, we're responsible for all expenses. So if we need to purchase additional rideshare addendum insurance on our vehicles, wear and tear, gas, and as you know, gas prices have been rising and our rates have been decreasing as far as what we're making. And so it's harder and harder to have any sort of profit margin left at the end of the day. We're also asking for transparency. There's a lot of their policies that are very ambiguous that affect our lives on a daily basis, such as their deactivation policies, which is equivalent to an immediate firing, which happens often unfairly and without notice to any of the drivers. Mm. Third, we're asking for some sort of protections. You know, if we get hurt on the job or we're sick and we're unable to continue working, there's no sort of protections for us. And then fourth, to have a recognized voice within Uber on any policies that that could potentially change and affect what we're doing. We want to have the right to have a voice at work.
I see. So how would you achieve that voice if for as long as Uber considers drivers independent contractors and not employees?
Well, we'd like them to recognize an association or a united group of drivers and ensure that we have a seat at the table during these decision-making processes.
Okay. But, I mean, it doesn't seem as if Uber's showing any desire to do that, though.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
They have not even reached out to us in our many attempts to contact them.
Now, in San Francisco today, do you have a sense as to how many drivers are participating? I mean, it's not just Uber, right? It's Uber and Lyft and any ride-hailing service driver that that can participate in this protest. Do you have a sense as to how many are?
Absolutely. It's definitely any rideshare drivers, and we encourage any other gig workers as well to come out, because this also, in the long run, will affect them as well. And so we ask them to stand in solidarity with us. We're expecting several hundred drivers, and just from the additional chitter-chatter I'm hearing, it looks like the turnout is going to be great, huge.
Well, you know, we did reach out to Uber to see if they could join us, and they sent us a statement. And I just want to read the statement to you, Rebecca. It says,
sure,
quote, "Drivers are at the heart of our service. We can't succeed without them. And thousands of people come to work at Uber every day focused on how to make their experience better on and off the road, whether it's more consistent earnings, stronger insurance protections, or fully funded four-year degrees for drivers or their families. We'll continue working to improve the experience for and with drivers." What's your response to their statement?
Typical. You know, if I'm glad that they're acknowledging that we're the heart of their business, but now they need to treat us like that. They can say it all they want, but their actions don't prove that, right? When you have the drivers who are out there risking their lives every single day, you know, making this company the value that they're at on their backs every single day, we deserve a fair wage for that.
Well, you know, it's so interesting because Uber points to studies that find that gross hourly earnings for ride-hailing drivers is roughly $21 an hour. They'll also point to the fact that since they added the tipping function into the app, that drivers have earned $1.2 billion in tips, and overall $78.2 billion through being Uber drivers since 2015. So, you know, they're saying to us that it's not so bad for drivers, that the flexibility, the contract nature of the work, and the overall per hourly wage, drivers are probably better off than this conversation might lead people to believe.
Mm-hmm. Well, first, I'd like to address that they point to this $21 an hour, but notice how they don't mention if that's before or after expenses. I would very well believe that the $21 an hour is obtainable prior to expenses.
Right. I mean, just to be clear, they say it's gross. It's gross. So that it definitely has to be before expenses. It's not net.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, as the drivers, we're responsible for everything from gas to the wear and tear, keeping our cars clean. All of those expenses come out of the driver's pocket. So $21 an hour, we also pay our own taxes on that. So if you figure out all those expenses, you're going to be well below $10 an hour by the time you take that into account.
Well, Rebecca, one more question for you here, because we're having this conversation with you because of the, you know, protests around the city that around the world, actually, that drivers are engaging in today. And of course, this IPO that's coming up at the end of this week. It's supposed to be supposed to raise more than $90 billion for Uber.
Mm-hmm.
Just your thought on the comparison of these two moments. What do you think?
Yeah. So, you know, for Uber, who's valued so high and can afford to pay their CEO a $45 million salary last year and offer him $100 million in stock options, I think that they can figure out a way to ensure that their drivers are making a living wage. Bottom line is, without us, what would Uber be?
Well, Rebecca Stack Martinez, an Uber driver who's helping to organize protest efforts in San Francisco, joining us today from San Francisco. Rebecca, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Magna.
All right. Well, let's turn now to Johanna Buya. She's with us from San Francisco as well. She's a business reporter for the Los Angeles Times, covering the technology industry with a focus on accountability. We have links to her reporting on Uber at onpointradio.org. Johanna Buya, welcome to you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Your reporting is absolutely outstanding on these issues. So first of all, let me just ask you, can you put Uber's IPO in perspective for us? I mean, how large is it and how significant is it for the company and for the tech market as a whole?
Sure. I mean, it's going to be one of the largest tech IPOs in recent history, if not, you know, in the history of technology. The company's expected to raise $9 billion, and they're pricing their shares at 44 to 50. Well, they're hoping to price their shares at $44 to $50 per share, and that would value the company at around nearly $90 billion or more. So it's a good chunk of change, and the company has needed to IPO for a long time. It's an incredibly capital-intensive business based on the way that they are operating, and they have sort of tapped a lot of the sources of funding in the private market. They've even turned to sovereign wealth funds. So the company and Dara Khosrowshahi, the chief executive, when he came in, he intended to get the company ready to go public for that reason. They need more funding, and a lot of it is because, you know, as you mentioned, they lost $1 billion, nearly $1 billion last year, and they don't expect to be profitable in the short term or anytime soon. So what they have to show is growth, and in order to show growth, they have to invest a great deal in continuing to subsidize rides for riders and customers, while also investing in things like self-driving cars and flying cars, which they're hoping is sort of a hedge on their bets on continuing to pay for drivers, because ultimately these products, they hope, will replace drivers.
Yeah. So this is so fascinating because they have to show growth in order to achieve profitability. But Uber, one of the things that marked its internal culture for many years was this growth at all costs here. So what kind of growth have they not been showing since 2015?
Sure. So it's they have to show growth in lieu of profitability at this point. So investors are looking at them and they know they're not going to be profitable. Why would they buy Uber stock? And that's because that they'll look at whether Uber is continuing to grow at the pace that it expects to. But over the last few quarters, Uber's growth in revenue and bookings has actually been flat, or has not grown as quickly as it had it in the past. So they have to continue to show that, and that requires a lot of investment, as we've seen in the history of Uber.
Well, Johanna Buya with us from San Francisco, stand by. Johanna's a business reporter for the Los Angeles Times, covering the technology industry with a focus on accountability. We are talking about Uber's IPO, worldwide protests from ride-hailing service drivers demanding better wages and better working conditions, and the big story that this tells us about the reality of the gig economy. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about Uber's looming IPO. When it goes public, the company could be valued at $90 billion, while at the same time, drivers today, ride-hailing service drivers, are protesting in many cities across the country and around the world, demanding better wages and working conditions for the very companies, such as Uber, that they work for and are valued so high. And I'm joined today by Johanna Buya. She's a business reporter at the Los Angeles Times, covering technology with a focus on accountability. And Johanna, help us dig into something here, because you heard Rebecca at the top of the show, an Uber driver protesting today, saying that, you know, she sees Uber as a company that has the means to pay its drivers better. But also, as you know, as we dig through the IPO documents, we see that Uber acknowledges that it has to further reduce driver incentives. It says, it admits itself, in order to achieve that, quote, path to profitability. So where is the disconnect here?
Sure. I mean, you can look at it, you know, one of two ways. On the one hand, and this is probably how investors look at it, you know, Uber can afford not to give in to driver demands and give them a minimum wage because they have hedged their bets on drivers through, you know, these research and development projects that ultimately is intended to replace drivers. And they've spent, you know, $487 million on R&D alone for their advanced technology arm. So investors see that and they probably think, well, we're not going to have to deal with drivers for much longer. So it doesn't make a ton of sense for us to invest so much money into giving them a minimum wage. And on the other hand, you can look at it as, well, Uber can't afford to give drivers that money because they've spent $487 million on these other R&D projects that they won't see a return on, you know, at least for another 10 years, if ever, because a lot of these projects have stalled in a number of ways. So the company is sinking a lot of money into, you know, this idea of being the Amazon for transportation. And that, again, is in an effort to show that they are growing, and they're trying to show, and then one way to show that growth is to show that you're expanding the kinds of services that you're offering. But the other thing that it does is it eases its reliance on drivers. Mm. You know, they created this independent contractor model in order to grow fast and grow affordably. Unfortunately, Uber realized that they actually still have to continue to give a chunk of the cost of the ride to drivers while also subsidizing rides for customers in order to expedite that growth and the demand or the supply. But they are unable to do much beyond that. They don't have much more money to spread across. They're investing in things that are much more future looking in order to hedge their bets on drivers.
Right. So let's talk about that for a second here, because you mentioned that before as well. And we have a comment that's come in on Facebook from Tyler Burke. Tyler says Uber doesn't care at all about its drivers. They're going to do nothing to help drivers at all. They actually plan to get rid of drivers in lieu of robo-taxis. I mean, the point being that in the future, Uber's looking to self-driving vehicles, as you said. So are they just playing a long game, that they're going to suffer the bad press and the constant legal battles over this question of independent contractors versus not? Because ultimately, as you said, they perhaps want to just shed needing human drivers at all.
Sure. I think that they're not playing. They realize that independent contractors are really critical to their service. And they've said that in their S-1. They've said that if there's any regulatory threat to the independent contractor model, that'll be incredibly, horrible for their business. In fact, it will, you know, take off, you know, it will handicap their main source of income. That being said, the company has also come around to the idea, just given the progress of self-driving, that they're probably going to have to incorporate drivers in their network, even if self-driving cars begin, going on the road they are not probably going to put self-driving cars on the road themselves, but with their partners start putting self-driving cars on their network, they'll still have to have, you know, a network of regular drivers driving Ubers in order to keep up with demand. So there is this, you know, on the one hand, this sort of moonshot ambition to replace all drivers and not have to pay drivers or anyone anything, and they can sort of keep all the profits. But that, given the progress of self-driving technology, particularly within, you know, Uber's self-driving arm, after all of these accidents, that is looking less and less likely.
Yeah. So that's in the future, though. We should just spend as much time as possible. And I'll get to calls here in a second. But talking about the reality right now for these many, many drivers who work for these companies, I'm looking at your reporting here in the LA Times that, first of all, as you note, just recently, Uber slashed its per-mile pay in Los Angeles County from 80 cents per mile to 60 cents per mile. So as far as I read that, that's a 25% cut, a major cut. And you even talk to a driver who rents his car from a ride-sharing company and is making so little that he sometimes has to sleep in that very car.
Yeah. So they Uber has made cuts in a number of markets, and it's really hurting a lot of these drivers, particularly those drivers who rely on this income, you know, not just for to make a living, but to pay for the car that they're using to make this income. So drivers, you know, Uber does say on average, you know, drivers make, you know, $21 an hour or whatever the number is. But that reality is not, you know, these are real people. This is not this sort of like average statistic. A lot of these people turn to Uber and Lyft for this low barrier access to flexible income. And oftentimes it's because they're desperate. And in order to make that income, they'll rent cars or they'll lease cars. So on top of, you know, wanting to be able to cover their cost of living, they need to cover the cost of renting this car in order to make this income. So lowering these per mile rates, you know, that is a huge hit to a lot of drivers.
Hmm. Well, Johanna Buya, stand by here for just a second because we do have a lot of callers who have some thoughts to share. So let's go to them. Laura is calling from Detroit, Michigan. Laura, you're on the air.
Hi, Megla. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. What's your thought for today?
I am a Uber / Lyft driver. I'm out of Detroit. I've been doing this since 2016. When I started, I had a 2016 Kia with 25 miles on it. Now, today, it's got 190,000 miles on it within a little bit over 2 years. To my recollection, the money has just gotten worse and worse as it's gone on. I started driving more Lyft than Uber because Lyft came out first with the tipping option. But at this point in the city of Detroit, hardly any of the customers tip because The way the wages are set, their fare is so high because we're now on a flat fee of $1 a mile here in Detroit. And if a ride is $30, I might get paid $14 and the client is paying $30 for a ride. I just feel that this has never been a money-making industry since I started. When I first started, I was clearing $45,000 a year in 2000, or grossing $45,000 a year in 2016. In 2017, I drove less and I was making $15,000 a year. I think 2018, I did like $8,000 a year. I'm driving less and less as my car is being torn up.
Yeah. Well, Laura, thank you so much for your call and from the perspective of what it's like to be a driver in Detroit. Johanna, Laura said that they have a flat per mile pricing there in Detroit. So are there different pricing models in different cities?
Yeah, there are. And in a lot of markets, they have something called upfront pricing. And so riders are given this sort of upfront fare that they're quoted based on what the company, you know, based on historical data as well as where they're going, has determined that ride will cost. But oftentimes that means that they're paying something that looks completely different than what the drivers are actually taking home. And sometimes it means that riders are paying more than drivers are taking home, much more. Or sometimes it means that they're paying a lot less than what drivers are taking home. And so that has been kind of a point of contention for drivers as well, this whole concept of upfront pricing. And one of the demands of drivers in this strike is transparency, not just for drivers, but also for riders, because a lot of them will speak to riders as they're toting them around and then let them know, well, you know, you may pay $40 for this, but I'm only going to be paid $15. And it has nothing to do, the rider and the driver, that cost is completely decoupled. So a lot of riders are completely surprised by that.
Has Lyft or Uber shown any willingness to introduce more transparency into their pricing?
Sure. Yeah. So Uber, on the part of the drivers, as part of their whole driver campaign during the turmoil that they faced in 2017, they introduced a number of features that was intended to increase transparency around what drivers are being paid, what Uber is taking out, what all of those fees are. So even drivers have told me that when they go into the app, it is much clearer what they're being paid. Are they all happy with all of those numbers? No, but they do know where it's going now.
Well, let's go back to the phones. Amelia is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Amelia, you're on the air.
Hi, Meghna. How are you?
I'm doing well. Go ahead, Amelia.
Sure. So I'm calling because I wanted to draw attention to this idea of like the nitty-gritty details of what it is that is on the backs of these drivers. I myself am, I'm a music teacher. I have a master's degree, but things have been tough out here in the ed world, and I had to jump right into something quickly. So I got into driving in November, and one of the things that I was wanted to share was that, you know, as a driver on a monthly basis, as somebody who puts in a full-time schedule of about 7 to 8 hours in the car on the road every day, my expenses to gas my car, my insurance, and my car note itself, about $600 or $700 a month, and then you have to tack on the tolls and all of the tickets that you might get. And you have to think about the tires that you have, the flats, and what the cost of this has been. I myself was unfortunately in an accident as on the clock as a driver on New Year's Eve, and I didn't know. And for drivers listening, please opt in for your personal insurance to have this additional risk coverage. It's a few bucks a month, but I didn't have that. And the damage was about $3,000, and Lyft deductible is $2,500. So, you know, on the backs of independent contractors is exactly what it means. I just want folks to really understand that if you're putting in full-time work, $1,100 to drive your car and do the job, like, I have to fuel the job with my own money, you know, about $1,100 a month. It's just not, it's not feasible, but it's like your guest said, we're desperate.
So,
you know?
Amelia, let me ask you a couple of quick questions here, because I want to be sure that I heard you correctly. Did you say that you are a music teacher right now?
So I am. That's been what I've dedicated the last 5 years of my life doing. And yeah, so, you know, one great thing about the Lyft culture is that you can talk to people and you can create opportunities through those experiences, that rideshare experience that they initially wanted to create. But what you find is that, you know, the vast economic disparities between drivers and riders are even Dutch so clear and apparent now that it becomes a very much service-oriented job. It is no longer that sort of experience that I think Lyft initially wanted to create. And yeah.
Right. So the reason why I'm asking, because it sounds like that driving, you're not doing it full time, right? Is it supplementing the other work that you're doing?
No. So currently I'm unemployed. I am not able to find a position. So I have been doing this full time. You know, September's rolling around, and it may just be that I may have to continue doing this if I don't get the calls.
Right.
And, you know, I just want to know, I mean, how exactly are these sort of wages, you know, I think that really it's not on the rider. I hate to say this, but I feel like the riders need to be willing to pay a little more if they understood the cost that we're incurring. I think they would be willing to pay more.
Well, Amelia, thank you so much for your call. Johanna, you want to just respond to what you heard Amelia say there?
Sure. And I think the reality is, once Uber goes public, as a lot of other companies have gone public, Netflix being a prime example of that, I mean, it's going to have to get more expensive because they don't have private venture capitalists funding and subsidizing every single ride for them anymore. And the public markets are typically, not always, but typically more sane than the private markets. And on top of that, I think, you know, Uber has charge riders so much less and less sometimes in a lot of markets because they have in the past historically prioritized the rider as the customer over the driver. Mm-hmm. So they did a lot of things that was, you know, amenable for riders that in the end hurt drivers. The company has said that they're not doing that anymore, that drivers, like they said to you, are the heart of their service. And they have done and invested a lot of money into building out a lot of features and perks for drivers. That being said, it's hard to shake, you know, the history of the company being one that is rider-centric. I think that if given the choice between raising costs for riders and lowering the prices for drivers, they'll always pick the latter.
Right. Well, Johanna, hang on here for a second, because now I want to turn to Sharon Block. She's joining us from Washington. She's the executive director of the Labor and Work-Life Program at the Harvard Law School, which is Harvard's forum for research and teaching on the world of work and its implications for society. She's also former principal deputy assistant secretary for policy at the U.S. Department of Labor and senior counselor to the Secretary of Labor for the council position she formerly held as well. Sharon Block, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
So really glad to have you here because there's yet another twist in this ongoing saga or story about where the gig economy is headed. And that is, as folks might know, there have been over the last several years lots of legal battles over whether or not a company can consider its workers, or drivers in this case, as independent contractors, or whether they have to consider them as employees. We can talk about the legal cases in a second. But recently there was a letter that came out of the Labor Department that said pretty explicitly to at least one company, nope, they're going to be independent contractors. Can you tell us about this letter and why it matters so much right now?
Sure. So the letter, as you said, came out last week. It's what the Department of Labor calls an opinion letter, which is a mechanism by which the department gives advice to parties about how they would view particular legal questions. Technically, either side, employees or employers, can ask for these opinion letters, but typically they are used almost exclusively by employers. So they present their side of the facts of whatever their question is. In this case, it was a gig economy company describing how their platform works and asking the department to give their opinion on whether the workers who, you know, derive income from the platform are employees or independent contractors. This was the first time that the department had opined really in any forum on this question. And the answer came back, you know, unsurprisingly, that they believed that they were independent contractors. Now, the implications of this, it's not just sort of information, it has real legal consequences.
Yeah. Well, Sharon Block, hang on for a second, because that's exactly what we want to explore when we come back. We are talking about Uber's big, enormous IPO that's coming up later this week, and today's worldwide protests in many cities from drivers, the very drivers that these ride-hailing services rely on, demanding better pay and better working conditions, and the big story that these two issues together tell us about the gig economy today. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about Uber's upcoming IPO. It could value the company at some $90 billion, while at the same time today, in advance of that IPO, ride-hailing drivers who work for these services around the world, in cities around the world, many of them are protesting for better pay and better working conditions. And the bigger story, this is all telling us about the gig economy. Callers, I see you. You're calling in from New York, Florida, Louisiana, Ohio, and Connecticut, and I promise I will get to you. But there's a couple more details that I want to dig into with our guests. Johanna Buya joins us. She's a business reporter for the Los Angeles Times. And Sharon Block is also with us. She's executive director of the Labor and Work-Life Program at Harvard Law School. And Sharon, so about this Department of Labor letter that we were talking about, the first time the department has opined about gig economy workers and whether they're independent contractors. First of all, we don't know the company that asked for this opinion, right? It doesn't sound like it's Uber, because they're saying that, you know, on their platform, in the workers can negotiate price and things like that. So it doesn't sound like it's Uber.
Right. I think the speculation is that it isn't Uber or Lyft, that it's more like a company that provides like services in your home. But no, they don't make the identity of the requester public.
Okay. And I'm wondering, if does that matter? Because it seems as if in the letter, the Department of Labor points specifically to this notion of economic dependence, that because of the flexibility in the app for this particular company, that its independent contractors or its workers don't have, quote unquote, economic dependence on them. So that's why they're independent contractors.
Right. So it should matter which company it is, because traditionally opinion letters are used to give very specific guidance to a particular factual situation, like a particular company. To me, what's alarming about this opinion letter is that it's actually written in a fairly broad manner. And so I think there are going to be a number of gig economy companies that are going to look at this letter and see that they can fit in within these standards that the department has set through the mechanism of this letter and think that they're okay in treating their workers as independent contractors, because it isn't overly specific about particular features of this company's platform.
Really? I mean, just to push back here on you a little bit on this, I'm seeing that here the letter states, your client does not impose requirements on how its service providers must perform their work, such as what transportation route to take, the order in which to clean an apartment, or the make, model, type, etc. of their working materials. I mean, so it seems rather specific to whatever this company is. So, is that not specific enough?
No, I mean, because there again, the letter is dealing with only one set of facts from the employer's perspective. What we don't know are the other ways, and we've learned through great reporting, like Johanna and other reporters that have covered this industry, that there are really complicated, complex ways that these platforms do control and direct the behavior of the workers who are getting jobs from the platform. We have no information about what those other mechanisms are. So while they may, you know, the letter says you don't impose these things, we don't know if this platform creates incentives to do things in a particular way that have the effect of controlling that behavior. You know, we've seen some of the New York Times reporting on how Uber algorithm works. We know that they actually, through these incentives, and even have done like psychological, you know, analysis, do effectively impose ways of doing this job. And so there's just a lot that we don't know, because this opinion letter, in my opinion, is a pretty poor way of dealing with this really complex issue, especially for the first time.
Okay. And so, Johanna Buya, weigh in here. What do you think the significance of this letter from the Department of Labor is?
Well, Uber and Lyft are facing regulatory threats on a number of levels across the country right now. So I think they're using anything and everything that they have, as well as other gig economies, to boost this idea that the drivers are, in fact, independent contractors. But to your point, you know, Uber does tell drivers where to go and what routes to take. And in fact, a lot of drivers will argue that much of what they do is controlled and dictated by Uber and Uber's algorithms. And so the company has found loopholes and found ways not to explicitly say you must do this way, and that's through their algorithm. That being said, a lot of drivers who are organizing these strikes and these movements have steered clear of talking about classification as sort of a point in their protest of Uber and Lyft, largely because a lot of drivers kind of disagree about it. And it is not something that every driver could stand behind. And, you know, this movement is really unique in that drivers are much more organized than they have in past movements. There has been national strikes before, but they haven't been as effective because they haven't all had the same demands. A lot of the demands that these individual driver groups across the country have are demands that their local drivers can stand behind, but they're palatable enough that it can be, you know, transferred from market to market, even across the globe.
Right.
And so they've steered clear of talking about independent contractor status for that reason.
Huh. Well, so Sharon Block, regarding this letter, I'm also thinking that the times or the efforts that drivers have made to change their classification through the courts, for example, I can't think of a time yet where a case like that has been successful.
So it has been really difficult. There are a couple of reasons for that. You know, one is it's actually been difficult for drivers to get these cases before the court, sort of on the merits, because of this issue of forced arbitration, where these platforms require drivers to sign away their right to go to court and instead to direct having these disputes resolved in arbitration. So that's been one problem. This letter is just going to make it more difficult, because what an opinion letter does is allow employers to have a defense. They get to say, well, you know, even if the judge in the court disagrees with whether the workers are independent contractors or not, it allows the companies to say, look, the Department of Labor told me what we were doing was okay.
Right.
And I relied on that. So it's again, just another hurdle for drivers, workers, to get that issue squarely and fairly before the courts. You know, what's going on in California is going to maybe a little bit different because of the recent decision in the California Supreme Court makes it more likely if drivers or workers are able to get this question into the courts that at least for the purpose of California state law, they very well may in fact be found to be employees.
I see. But the bottom line about the significance of this Department of Labor letter, though, is what you were just saying, that it provides companies a plausible defense, as you said, that the government itself has said we're doing it right.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. Well, I promised our callers that we would go back to them, and there are many. So let's roll through a bunch of them. Let's go to Dan, who's calling from Syracuse, New York. Dan, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Go ahead.
So I just wanted to share my experience. I'm a student here in Syracuse, and I drive part-time, you know, very limited hours. Sometimes I won't drive at all in a week. But it's been pretty positive. I make decent money, you know, especially when there's surge pricing. I don't really drive beyond then because, you know, then the money isn't really that good. It's you know, probably closer to $10 or $12 an hour than that 21 figure, you know, even before taxes that you mentioned before. Mm-hmm. And I was shocked when I heard that Uber operated at a loss. Like, I don't know how many people they employ other than drivers or what their expenses might be. But, you know, to me, they're making, you know, upwards of 50% on these fares for doing basically, you know, from my perspective, nothing.
Right.
And, you know, we're doing all the work and we're getting, you know, maybe, you know, sometimes, you know, people are saying less than 50% of the fare. And that's just insane. Yeah.
Well, Dan, thank you so much for your call. Johanna, let me turn to you back to you on this, because we also have a question that's come in from Derek Peters on Twitter, echoing what Dan says. Derek wants to know, I'd love to know what Uber's overhead is beside the app and the drivers.
Yeah, a lot of that is they have their own employees. They basically are a small town now based on the number of employees that they have. And yes, they have, you know, a ton of money that they're spending on research and development. And again, it goes back to this Amazon of transportation thing. They're trying to build out bikes and a scooter program. And they've taken on, and it's interesting because their whole independent contractor model was so that they did not have, you know, cars on their balance sheet. They didn't have to pay these drivers. But in the past few years, they've started to take on, you know, actual hardware and put that on their balance sheet. And that includes bikes, scooters. It will eventually include self-driving cars. They have this flying car program that they've poured a lot of money into. So there is a considerable number of things that they're investing in. And on top of that, they are subsidizing these rides. It's not as if, you know, these rides are riders are getting these rides for as cheap as they're getting it based on the market. That's an artificial market that Uber has created.
Right. Well, Kathleen is calling from Sarasota, Florida. Kathleen, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say, for me, as an Uber driver, working as an independent contractor has been supremely beneficial. I need the flexibility. The problem is, I don't know how you would regulate the percentage that Uber takes. That's annoying, you know. But I think the other problem is a lot of the drivers have come from traditional jobs and they're not familiar with how to file their taxes as an independent contractor. They end up with these tremendous tax bills that they don't know how to manage. So I'm, you know, there have been a lot of opportunities that come my way, but and I'd like to see Uber take less.
Oh, Kathleen, it looks like we're losing your line there. But Kathleen from Sarasota, Florida, thank you so much for calling. Let's go to one more call. Let's go to Jason, who's calling from Cleveland, Ohio. Jason, you're on the air.
Hello. I just had a few comments. So the last caller, we're talking about your guest speaking about subsidizing the ride. They're not subsidizing those rides when it is prime time, right? When there is a huge demand, the rates get enormous, and it's a matter of convenience. It's a perfect capital system. People with the means are able to leave immediately from a concert or a game, and they pay a premium for that. And when I started, I got 80% of that. Now, with the current model, you have no clue. And I would say it's a great comparison of a consultant and a slave. A slave hopes that he is going to get fed and taken care of, but he has no clue what that's going to be. A consultant says, what is the job? What am I expected to do? When is it due? And they can make an evaluation of whether or not they want to take that job. For us, we're penalized for not taking every single ride.
Right.
And we can be just completely fired for these petty things in our point of view, and then we have no right or say. So Lyft has already added an advisory council. Uber could do the same thing, but Uber has always been that corporate greed monster. The only reason I still do it is because with the new changes in the tax law, I can actually write off my Uber to lower my adjusted gross income, which reduces my student loans. And then when I take advantage of public service loan forgiveness, I can pay back the least amount.
Well, so Jason, I'm gonna take it back from you there, and thank you so much for your call. I hear the effort, though, that you're putting into making all these pieces of your financial life work. Sharon Block and Johanna Buya, we've just got a couple of minutes left. And Sharon, I wanted to ask you, in hearing all of these callers and the complexity of the options or the reality of the gig economy, I return over and over again to a basic question: that aren't our fundamental models of employment are simply too antiquated for the economy that we're moving towards now? And if that's the case, what should we do about it?
No, I don't disagree. And I think what you're hearing from folks really brings that out. But I think allowing these companies to just choose to take themselves out of these basic safety net protections, you know, those values about trying to protect people so that they have a basic living wage, so that they're protected if they get hurt on the job, if they are unemployed for some period, those values should endure. And we need to figure out how to adapt our laws to ensure that you can't have these companies just opting out of the system. But to throw those protections away just can't be the answer. So I think, you know, we need to think seriously, and hopefully, you know, I'll just say we will have a Department of Labor sometime in the not too distant future that wants to think through those challenges, you know, in a way that continues to be true to those values.
Hmm. Well, Johanna Buya, last thought today goes to you on what Sharon said, or also if you want to help us look into your crystal ball about what might be come up next for Uber.
Sure. I mean, to Sharon's point, I think that's exactly what drivers are demanding. You know, in lieu of demanding being classified as an employer, all they want are the protections that labor activists have fought for years for employees. And they want it's because, I mean, you heard it from the last caller. I mean, he has to put all of this effort into cobbling together this finance. And Uber is essentially just a means to get a lower student loan rate. I mean, that is kind of the reality for independent contractors everywhere. They are not working within a traditional labor environment. And, you know, these companies are not putting enough effort into giving them the knowledge and educating them on how to operate within this independent contractor model, because the independent contractor model has existed for the history of the United States, and it hasn't always been operated in a way that it has left the people who are providing this critical service for these companies sort of out in the cold, out in the dark, not knowing how to make ends meet.
Yeah. Well, Johanna Buya, business reporter at the Los Angeles Times, who covers technology with a focus on accountability. Johanna, it's been great to have you. Your reporting is terrific. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Sharon Block, executive director of the Labor and Work Life Program at Harvard Law School. Sharon Block, it's been terrific to have you as well. Thank you so much for your insight.
Thank you.
And folks, I'm going to leave you with two thoughts from listeners who've commented online. Jonathan Weir says, people may have been misled about the ability to maintain a singular job in this industry. It should always have been approached as supplemental income. Whereas Roberto 1194 says, Uber's originators will do what all disruptors do, go public and award themselves a fortune for being so smart, this time using technology to exploit public infrastructure and the underclass workers that provide the services. Go to onpointradio.org to let us know what you think. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.